Welcome to Greycast, exploring the world of Greyhawk one podcast at a time. This podcast is all about bringing the classic World of Greyhawk setting to life through Greyhawk creators, Greyhawk lore, Greyhawk streamers, Greyhawk stories, and of course, the vibrant Greyhawk community of gamers. Thank you for tuning in, and let the exploration of Dungeons & Dragons' most classic and revered setting, the World of Greyhawk, begin now.
Hello, Greyhawkians. We're back on the path to adventure. It's time for another session of Greycast, and tonight we have someone special. We're rejoined by your friend and mine, the renowned Les. Yeah. Oblivion Seeker is back to talk about more Appendix N bits and pieces and good little cracklins. And also, like always, I'm going to do a live on the spot putting of my co-host. And once I finish introducing this, I'm going to let him lead and I'm going to drop profound tidbits as they come to the front of my mind. Because he seems to have a better grasp of the structure of our program this evening or this morning or whatever it is.
You're going to leave a trail through the labyrinth, right?
Yes, yes. So I'm going to try not, and I'll leave the breadcrumbs as you drop them. I may eat a couple, but I'll leave enough that we can find our way back out of the labyrinth. But so we're going to dive deep through the, what is it, like a portal, a crossing gate? What do they call those? The link to the Feyland.
Gates and portals,
little openings, and so we're gonna poke our head in there against, you know, conventional wisdom, because most folks are warned not to do such things because the fairies will get you and all of that.
Go into the woods.
Yeah. So we're gonna find out. Is it just wives' tales? Are they real? Do they? And how do they relate to Greyhawk? So we're gonna spend some time hanging out, talking about the fairies and the Feywild and all the cool lore and tales associated with such. So, Oblivion Seeker, welcome back, man.
Hey, good to be back.
Yeah. Mateus, good to see you. You look good.
Thank you.
I mean, our listeners can't really tell that, but take it from me. Looking good. So, Mateus, you kind of had a structure in mind for this one. So why don't you take that away?
All right.
Like, how are we going to start this off, my man?
Well, first, since this is Appendix N and adjacent, we're looking at that list in the appendix of, is that the AD&D Dungeon Master's Guide?
Correct.
And also in the back of the Moldvay Fantasy Reading List in the back of Moldvay Basic. And we've come to fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
Which it might strike you as odd, but these are the basic fantasy building blocks that Gary Gygax had in the back of his head. These are the ingredients that eventually make up Greyhawk. And so by looking at these ingredients, we can start individually, we can start putting these ingredients into our Greyhawk. And hopefully by the time this series is done, our Greyhawks will look a little bit more like Gary's Greyhawk, simply because we're drawing from the same sources. That's my little intro to recap of this series. But so, Les.
Yes.
Why this topic? How does this topic give us a bird's eye view? Maybe jump into some stuff that Gary did with fairies and fairy tales and this kind of thing. Give us a taste of what's to come here.
Sure. In fairy tales, you come across some very archetypal figures, and I think it's worth mentioning that in Appendix N, not the list itself, but if you read the prose that accompanies the list, He talks about inspirations for the imagination that we experience when we're young and that stay with us. And two of the examples he gives are Andrew Lang's Books of Fairy and the Brothers Grimm. And when you look at Gygax's work, I think you'll see examples of this. I know that the later Igsberg material, the Castle Zagig material, actually has at one point a troll underneath a bridge, which should sound familiar to some people.
Sure.
Of course, there's an adventure called The Hermit, and The Hermit features rather prominently in House in the Borderland as well. And we're going to look at how that kind of figure factors into these things, the hermit in the wilderness kind of idea. And also in Knight Errant, the collection of Gord the Rogue stories, there is Gord embarks on, along with one of his companions, on a quest to recover some magic mushrooms, literally magic mushrooms, that unfortunately for them only appear when both moons of Oyth are half full, and also are protected and sacred to the Pukan, who are a type of fae, who are none too happy to have their mushrooms violated.
I hate it when that happens, when someone violates my
mushrooms.
Oh, sorry. Different folklore. That's more of a Shire thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Farmer Maggot.
By the way, for those who are doing the home game, and don't know, Grimm's fairy tales include some ones like Rapunzel, Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella. So those are some, you know, among many others.
Yes.
Aren't the five Chinese brothers part of the Grimm's fairy tale? Five or seven Chinese brothers? It's like it's like some of his fairy tales, not only were they just a fantastical, fun, whimsy thing, but there was a lesson to be learned somewhere strung through the tale that was meant to be discerned at some point while hearing the fairy tale. And the Chinese brothers comes to mind.
Yeah, the seven Chinese brothers is it's kind of related to these kinds of tropes. There was a children's book in 1938 called The Five Chinese Brothers by Claire Bishop, and that was really the source of that. It's a retelling of, which is a retelling of a Chinese folk story, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So it is relevant. Which is called The Ten Brothers Incident. So
that's the book I'm thinking of. Yeah, that's not a Grimm's thing, but I'm thinking, because I just Googled it and I see the cover of it and I'm like, oh, that's the book.
It's a retelling of a Chinese folktale, and that ties into broadly what we're going to be speaking about tonight.
Yeah, and so the example you used was in that new version of you were mentioning the bridge with the troll underneath it, that is in that new Castle Zagig book that is that Troll Lord has that.
It's in one of the Troll Lord publications. Yeah, I don't remember which one, but I remember reading it and getting a good chuckle out of it.
Yeah. Okay.
It's just outside of Igsberg. There's a bridge with a troll.
Yeah. All right. So you mentioned something, and that brings a question to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Chinese folk tales. What is the difference between a folk tale, folklore, and a fairy tale?
A folklore, as the term implies, and I want to point out these are purely largely academic distinctions. Like, we can demonstrate a certain degree of flexibility when speaking of these things, but as a general rule, folklore is a body of knowledge pertaining to a people, right, or a region. Folk tales are the tales that are told by a community. Fairy tales are a specific subset of folk tales that, unlike the normal folk tale, and unlike legends tend to have some sort of religious or mythic kind of, you know, this is the origin of something aspect to them, or this is how this constellation came to be, this is this tale of this great hero. The folk tale and the fairy tale are related to each other, but the folktale tends to be more specific. If you think about fairy tales, I'll just ask you a question as an example. Where does Rumpelstiltskin live?
Oh, no, this I forget.
Isn't he like in a basement or something? Or
I mean, place, basement? Place. I mean, place.
Oh, Russia. That's a Russian tale, isn't it, Rumpelstiltskin?
No, he's in a. Isn't he in a forest? I read this a couple of weeks ago to my kids. Isn't he like in a forest somewhere with a little cottage?
That's not what I'm asking, though. What specific location?
Does it say?
Oh, I'm that would kind of be the point.
Rasputin. Yeah. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, Rumpelstiltskin was one of the Brothers Grimm stories, among other things.
Yep.
And it's a tale that would have pre-existed that they would have gathered. But yeah, the general idea here is, and when do they all take place or seem to?
Oh, you know.
Once upon a time.
I almost said a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Which is where that idea comes from.
That's right.
But you have this, you have a non-specific story in terms of setting, quite often in terms of setting and chronology. Like, when does this take place? Where does it take place? It takes place a long time ago, and it takes place with a merchant or whatever. Now, there are some fairy tales, particularly older ones, that are a lot more specific in terms of location. But on the whole, fairy tales tend to be pretty stripped bare, which is why they're an ideal form of short fiction that way. They are minimalist as can be.
And they have lots of forms. We keep retelling these things, and every time we retell it, there's a new twist on it. And that's not new. That goes back to, like, you check some of the original forms of these fairy tales in Hans Christian Andersen or the Brothers Grimm, and they are far more brutal than the versions that I grew up watching on TV, like the Disney versions or whatever.
And I think there are reasons for that, which we'll go into shortly. But that's certainly true. And another thing that's true is, you know, you mentioned folklore. Fairy tales and folk tales and also ballads, for example, the child ballads, which are named for the person who actually compiled them, which are a single series of, like, I believe, English, Scottish, and American ballads. They convey, there's an idea of passing along information. Fairy tales, unlike some folk tales, by the way, also tend to not be quite as moralistic. In other words, if a folk tale is kind of trying to convey a moral message, the morality of a fairy tale is going to be a little slippery. How many times do characters in fairy tales not do what they're supposed to do and at times commit murder, arson, some sort of transgression, and then profit from it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And again, I think we can see the appeal in the world of Greyhawk, right?
Mm-hmm. Chaos kind of reigns.
Well, you can imagine Lord Robillard as a fairy tale figure very easily. Or Gord or some of these other characters. You know, they aren't necessarily morally nice. That would be one other aspect of them. Fairy tales are not necessarily moralistic
in the same way. It's interesting that you say that, because I know I've read the Greyhawk is not intended to be the good always wins, you know, good versus evil type, you know, trope. It's meant to be a little grayer, a little bleaker, a little less good always wins. Evil has a place and it does things and it organizes and it wins.
The good guys aren't necessarily, they don't necessarily start out as good guys. It's like sometimes they commit good acts by virtue of simply, it being, you know, I don't want to say a crime of opportunity. Let's say a good deed of opportunity. It's like it's there and they kind of stumble into it.
Yeah. I think, did I read somewhere talking about the, like, was it the Circle of Eight or Mordenkainen? Like, neutrality plays a huge role in the outcome of things in Greyhawk, where Mordenkainen might be the kind of person that, well, the only reason he really did you a good turn is because he needed to in order to further his agenda versus doing good for the purpose of goodness isn't nearly as prevalent.
There's definitely that within the world, or in some interpretations, some takes on the world of Greyhawk.
Hmm.
Here, I'm thinking specifically of the way that adventures are set up. and the way that loot is set up, and also the nature of the supernatural in Greyhawk to some extent. So
I think you should say more about that. I want to understand that better.
Okay. I think one way to look at it would be to address the question, first off, what is a fairy?
Yes, what is a fairy? And what are they?
We now tend to think of fairies as Tinkerbell, right? Or some similar Disneyfied or Victorian bolderized kind of image of, you know, oh, they're these sweet little things and blah, blah, blah. That's not necessarily what they were. This goes back, I think, and again, I'm sure that people are going to think of a million different examples and different takes from different regions of the world, but early humans seem to have had a thing for what people refer to as a genius loci, a spirit of place, right? So if you move into a place and you build something there, you want to make offerings to the spirit of the place so that the spirit of the place doesn't mess with you. And if you think about certain types of fairies, like brownies or whatnot, you know, you always want to leave a little food or milk out for the fairy.
Knock on wood.
Because they might get ticked off and do something harsh, kill your animals loose or burn down your house.
Yeah, that's the expression, knock on wood, right?
Exactly.
Knock on wood to appease the wood fairies, the dryads.
And you have, within this context of the spirit of the place, you also have the idea that there are places just outside the firelight. There are places outside the warmth of home and hearth.
Beyond the north wind.
And you cross that threshold and you enter a realm of potential danger.
Yep.
Because the spirits there might not be amenable to your presence. So you have the idea of potentially a spirit of a cave, or a spirit of a mountain or a forest, or a specific portion of a forest or mountain. You have, and from there you start getting a diversity of creatures. You wind up with descriptions of what would later come to be termed as elves or dwarves. But in these early stages, there doesn't seem to have been much differentiation between different types of creatures, right? They were all these supernatural creatures with, and in some cases also, one might want to consider the following. Say that you've come into a land that was previously occupied, but there's no sign of the occupants, and they left behind some stone structures. Or you've moved into a portion of land, and weirdly, the mushrooms or the trees as they grow start forming patterns like circles or spirals. There has to be a reason for these things, right? But there's nobody there doing it that you can see. So these places become associated with what some scholars and students of the of these kinds of forms call the other world.
Mm-hmm.
Like these are places where the spirits cross over. And they've made these things, right, as markers and way stations and posts to themselves and to others who are in the know. And you also have the idea as well that someone might move in and they might see some of these behaviors that I've just discussed. And if you're a Roman, for example, you might start incorporating, well, you know, this river spirit is kind of similar to this god, or this deity is kind of similar to Apollo. So we're going to say it's an aspect of Apollo, right? So we're going to incorporate that stuff. But then as Rome's culture shifts and as you have the rise of Christianity, that's all paganism. And furthermore, it's paganism overlaid on top of older or alien forms of paganism. So you wind up with this idea that, you find this a lot in some of the, something called the Book of Oberon, which was published recently. It exists in manuscript in the Shakespeare Folgers Library. And it is a grimoire for summoning nature spirits and fairies.
Oberon being the character in A Midsummer Night's Dream,
who actually all about. Is actually derived from a French tradition, and in turn, it's believed that one of the forerunners of this would have been Albrecht, the dwarf, of course, in who in the Nibelungen.
In the Ring of the Nibelungen, yeah, the Wagner opera cycle, yep.
And the, and specifically the German, actually the not just that, but the German epics that and sagas that inspired Wagner's opera. So again, you have this idea of this creature who over time the name is transformed, travels from Germany to France. The name is altered to Oberon or something like that. Then the English pick up on it, and the nature of the personality changes across cultures, right? So you have that. You have also the idea that within this book, what's interesting is some of the figures whose names and sigils and the ways to summon and appease them are offered are listed in other grimoires as demonic entities. So it's a good bet that they were they were spirits of some kind, like localized spirits, who then over time became, you know, categorized as different, as a fae of this, or as a nature spirit of this, or in some takes a demon of this, an actual evil entity. You also have this idea of the dead. What happens to someone when you can't see, when their body's not moving anymore, right? You have, and again, this idea of an adjacent other world, and the idea that there would be thresholds for crossing it. And in some cultures, it appears that was identified with, you know, it became conflated in some, it was probably already conflated. There was probably a mixture of just an idea that if the dead go to that cave, right? And that cave might also have its own spirit. So you appease the cave. And if you think about appeasing the spirits on the land that you've built, that's not dissimilar to leaving out something, leaving out, say, food and drink for your ancestors once a year as a seasonal thing, which is another cultural motif that you see across different sites. Now, the thing here also is that as the stories develop, you wind up with lore associated with it. You wind up with tales associated with it, where someone might be taken by a, you know, they're found particularly attractive by some spirit, or they're found particularly amusing by some spirit. Shakespeare kind of riffs off of this in Midsummer Night's Dream. And they are either isolated or taken off to the other world itself. Puck being in the play being a good example of someone who's kind of hauled off to the other world, right? And in a lot of these stories, the people are taken there until the vain and sometimes flighty spirit is bored with them, or until they've somehow transgressed, and then they're booted out, and they'll find that like 100 years have passed in the quote-unquote mundane world. So you were taken off to another world by a spirit, and then it grew tired of you, or you ticked it off and it booted you back, or either time has changed in such a way that you no longer recognize the place, or you become an old man or old woman, or something similar has happened where you're out of sync with the world. You can no longer be part of that mundane world. You've been touched by something from another place.
Are there spots then, bringing this back to Greyhawk for a moment, are there spots on the Greyhawk map where there is these established connections to the Fae, to the other realm in terms of Greyhawk's other realm? Are there specific spots where this is more frequently, more likely to occur?
I think that when we're looking at that, there are two things we need to take into consideration. One would be, let's look at that Gord novel, or that Gord story, where clearly there is a spot where the Pukon have set up shop, right? Mm-hmm. And that's in the Gnarly. In Sargent, you find that in the Whelkwood, there is a stone circle that is supposed to open into this, presumably where the Seelie Court is. Mm. So you do have location, specific locations that are associated with fey creatures, but I think that there's something I would argue even more useful that one can come up with when thinking about this, which is fairy tales and ballads tend to overlap. Like, you'll find that there are Scottish and Irish ballads and Old Norse songs and things like this that find themselves echoed later in, say, Cornish or British or Scottish fairy tales or folk tales, and in Scandinavian folk tales, you find echoes of these stories, right? And the thing that I always think about with that would be the idea, I've mentioned before Manly Wade Wellman, the Appendix N author.
Mm-hmm.
Wellman's, and I think I might have mentioned John the Balladeer, and the idea there is that John is a traveling musician in the Appalachians. So this is present day, but he has a silver-stringed guitar, silver because of its power and potency over otherworldly creatures. And he's also called Silver John in part for that reason. But he has a complete knowledge of just a knack for calling on the right piece of music, the right song, which tells the story of whatever supernatural opponent he's having to face. It's buried, the truth is buried in these ballads. And the truth of these monsters that are out there are buried in the lore that the ballads in turn are preserving. Now, if we think about the old faith and the old lore bards in the world of Greyhawk, I think you can find a similar idea and a similar thing for DMs to exploit, right? These stories that are passed down, where there was a horrible monster here once upon a time, or there was this evil despotic ruler once upon a time, and the stories that have been transmitted through time, through music, through the music and poetry of song, these are all ways of preserving knowledge, and they actually contain information that could be useful to the party. It's a nice way for the DM to incorporate the information without doing an info dump. And it gives bards and druids and rangers access to information that suits their characters.
Mm. That's really cool. A good way to utilize players. So we've talked a little bit about the origin of the fae. We've distinguished between fairy tales and folk tales. Are there specific authors that you wanted to talk about? That are on Appendix N or mentioned in that paragraph or elsewhere that you think are important to bring up at this point?
I think that before we do that, it might be worth looking at a couple of factors. First, I think it's worth looking at authors whose works kind of laid the foundation for all this stuff. And the reason I'm mentioning that is Fritz Leiber, who, of course, had a huge impact on Greyhawk, on D&D, on Gygax personally. He had a column back in the 60s and 70s in, I think it was, it might have been whatever Amazing had become at that point. But basically it was a review column, right? And the subject of movies came up, but he was free to write about whatever he wanted, really. And he in one article, he started talking about films and films of the fantastic. And, of course, he was talking about your Harryhausens and everything else. But then he mentioned a specific film, which he argues is got to be one of the great fantasy films of all time. And that would be Jean Cocteau's 1940s version of Beauty and the Beast. Which, I mean, that film itself has its own history. The conditions under which it was produced, you're talking the end of World War II, German occupation, all this stuff. There's craziness behind the scenes, right? It was one of these things where you're amazed that such a work could get finished, given the circumstances and whatnot. But what's more striking is that people who've seen the Disney version of Beauty and the Beast will recognize the visual components of the film. That film was, along with Cocteau's Orfe, a major influence also on Tim Burton and Guillermo del Toro. what I would argue is one of the great monster performances with the portrayal of the Beast, and you have a truly sensual, in a good way, not sexual, but sensual depiction of a monster who is self-hating and who is regarded by this woman at first with utter contempt. And you also get this gorgeous imagery. For example, as she's walking down the corridors, the candles and torches are being held by these outstretched arms. And as she passes, each arm in the row moves so that the way ahead of her is illuminated. And these are just great, creepy visual details that I think any DM could exploit, right? I can see why Fritz Leiber would love that movie, besides the fact that it's just a great movie. But this is, again, going back to a 17th century fairy tale, which was also used in Lang's fairy books back in the Victorian era. Lang's fairy books, he was a Scottish writer who compiled different fairy tales and folk tales from around the world. And he and his wife kind of rewrote them. Some of them are a little tamer than they were in the original, but it's a great compilation. And they're all named for different colors. Like you have the red book, the blue book, the purple book, the pink book. And they all contain these great stories. And these are, but with these, with that, I want to point out that that's in a literary tradition. There, in addition to distinction between fairy tales and folklore, you have a distinction between types of fairy tales, right? You have the literary fairy tale, which kind of arises among a lot of French authors. Charles Perrault is, of course, one of the most famous. But you also have a number of women writers, Marie Dolnoy, Charlotte Rose LaForce, and I think Marie-Jeanne Lettier. I think that's how you pronounce her name. I can never remember. But they produced these books of fairy tales as well. And you have very much in them this kind of notion, again, of transgression. A lot of them tend to loop back to the idea of marriage or property and theft. Perhaps one of the most famous actually does have a kind of backdoor Greyhawk connection. And that would be this tale of Bluebeard, which you may be familiar with. It's the woman whose husband has the secret room that she's not supposed to go into or ever look in. And it's a variation on an older one, but the Greyhawk connection, such as it is, would be, you may remember, I believe it's Sir Bluto, the killer who Lord Robillard and company managed to foil in the city of Greyhawk. And he's actually first mentioned in one of the modules. I want to say it's... Is it White Plume Mountain that Sir Bluto comes up? But anyway, the point is that in a later update to that kind of mythology, he was also a serial killer who was loose in the city of Greyhawk. He was killing people specifically for magic rituals. And Eric Mona wrote an early Bluto Sans Pite. That's who I'm thinking of. And it, sure enough, White Plume Mountain. I just pulled up my notes. Some of the story of him comes up in Living Greyhawk Journal number 2. And Eric Mona wrote an adventure called River of Blood, which features, and it was a highly controversial adventure at the time, but it features children going missing from the low quarter of the city of Greyhawk. And one of them comes out, and she keeps talking about the Blue Men. And there's this whole thing about the children being made to wear wedding dresses. And it very much seems to be inspired in part. There are elements of it, particularly the bridal elements, that remind you of Bluebeard. And also one of the possible sources for Bluebeard, Gilles de Rais, the alleged serial killer and occultist who was a follower of Joan of Arc. So he, along with another possibly, well, with Gil DeRay, there's no question that he's real. But with whether the allegations against him were actual or not, but there's another folkloric figure who kind of inspired that helped in, also in, may have inspired the Bluebeard tale. But you can certainly see how Bluebeard and Blue Men kind of tie together there, and the idea of what's in the room, which in the case of the Bluebeard story is basically the bodies of all his ex-wives and lovers. So yeah, that's another kind of connection between the literary fairy tale, possibly, and some horrors of history, and the world of Greyhawk. Highly controversial adventure, one of the early RPGA Living Greyhawk adventures, but nonetheless, there it is.
So let's, you've mentioned several authors. I want to explore next how is a fairy tale, can you briefly tell us how a fairy tale is structured, how the stories unfold, and how DMs can use the familiar beats of a fairy tale to help structure their own when they're writing a scenario for Saturday night and they've got, you know, a couple hours.
Yeah, sure. Here we get back into the other tradition, which would be the oral tradition. Because if you're telling a story, you want it to be succinct, right? If you're trying to captivate your audience, you don't want to lose them, which I probably already have done several times, but that's okay. Because they can pause me because it's a podcast. But what you have with a storytelling moment is you want to go right through things. So I would say here are some things that you need to keep in mind. First, boil your narrative or whatever potential adventure scene you have down to its bare bones. In Dance Macabre, Stephen King points out just two examples. A woman runs off with some money and she finds an old castle and she goes into the castle because it's storming and the man inside the castle takes her in and feeds her, but then the man's mother murders her. And then people come looking for the girl and the stolen money. Does that sound kind of like a fairy tale?
Sure does.
That's Psycho. Or let's do a brother and sister and their friends go at well outside of where people are living, and they encounter a strange man who marks them and puts a curse on them. And then they find the house and they go into the house, and unfortunately, the people who live in the house begin killing and eating them. Now, does this sound kind of like Hansel and Gretel?
Oh, absolutely. Very similar. Bit,
yeah.
It's Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Now, the point is that you have the bare bones of the story, which King argues, and I think this is true of a lot of genre fiction, right? It's mythic. There is, going back to this idea of there being otherworldly things, right? Or some things that you don't want to transgress, some boundaries. You have a sense of awe and wonder underneath. Strip away the things, and there's something fundamentally frightening about the ideas that are there, the basic core ideas. And it goes back to that idea of sense of wonder and conveying to your players a sense of wonder. And with wonder, I mean it in the traditional sense. I mean awe, and by awe, I don't mean, oh, that's awesome. I mean overwhelming reaction to something.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and also I that sense of there being something just beyond that which is visible or the elements of the story or the adventure itself. You know, in science fiction, they have the idea that there's also the idea of the sense of wonder. And with that, I always think, you know, how old is the light from the stars that you're when we look up at night? Each star, how old is that star? You know, in terms of the light that we're now receiving on Earth, or what happens to information past the threshold of the event horizon of a black hole? What happens to matter? What would happen to consciousness? And you start thinking about these things and your mind kind of melts a little, the same way it does with Lovecraftian horror. It's a similar kind of thing. In one case, it might be, oh, the wonders of the universe. In the others, it might be the horrors of the universe. And in this case, It's the, there are things that are intangible. There's a reason I think the Victorians responded so strongly to fairy tales and ghost stories. And that would be in no small part because they were living in an increasingly rationalistic and industrialized society, right?
Right.
And the flip side of that is, you know, I always think of the idea that in a, to use another horror analogy, Rosemary's Baby, when you see the person in the waiting room reading the issue of Time magazine that says, "Is God dead?" And you have the realization that to Rosemary and her circle of friends, that probably isn't much of a concern, but the devil certainly is.
Right.
And that's what I mean there, that idea that that there's a sense of awe and wonder and mystery. I think that would be the other thing that's key to that. And if you break it down to the component parts, you have that kind of thing that will give a visceral reaction. So that'd be one thing. Take your supernatural elements and your mundane elements, break them down. The other thing would be to allow for figures and experiences who are liminal. And by that, I mean, they're in that space where they're in this world, but they're of another world, or you've crossed over into the other world and you're now on that threshold and having that kind of weird experience where things aren't quite right.
Right.
You can think of this in terms of a trickster archetype. You encounter a character who, you know, they might give you a gift, but then that gift might turn out to screw you.
Mm-hmm.
Or they might, you know, do whatever. That these kinds of figures are very vital. The Mad Hermit, I you know, we were talking earlier about those ideas of stone circles and whatnot. Take that one way and it's a bunch of dancing fairies that cause the stone circle. Take it another way and it's a bunch of witches who are having their Sabbat and worshiping the Horned One.
Right.
And sometimes mm-hmm. people believe the same thing, you know, both things simultaneously about the same site.
Yeah. Yeah.
So take these elements. Yeah. I would say take these elements and work at that. Work on those kinds of angles with them. You know, you have. I want to go back to the idea of Kuntz's of Rob Kuntz's The Stalk, where if memory serves, there is a stalk in the gnarly forest that goes up and you wind up in a cloud giant's castle. And of course, this should sound familiar to most fans of fairy tales. And a lot of Kuntz's creations throughout the books that he's published, like of magical items and things, have that kind of fairy tale resonance. You know, the item, the singing harp kind of idea that you get right. with the Jack and the Beanstalk story. Mm-hmm. And those are, I think, neat ways to introduce those kinds of fantastic elements. Via treasure as well. We were talking about introducing them via character. You can introduce them via object.
Objects, right. And I like what you're saying because what you're saying is to take the story beats that you would have in a fairy tale, break them down to their super simplest essence, and then use that. If you want to be inspired by it, use that to help form your own story beats. And then you can also do that with characters and different things. Sometimes you can actually overtly reference fairy tales, like when Wily Hobbit in Daggerdale had the seven dwarves sitting. seven dwarves sitting at the inn there in Daggerdale, which was humorous after he, you know, these seven dwarves come in looking all dirty from the mines. Yeah. But a better one is, you know, you can use some of these basic fairy tale stories. My kids are lost in the forest and there's talk of a witch in there, you know, or, a hag in the forest, there's a local werewolf who recently ate a kid and her grandmother, You know, you can, if you want to be more explicit with some of these things, you can absolutely work them in, but you're talking more than that. You're talking like behind the scenes, things.
Well, and, here's the thing. I mean, you have to bear in mind Beauty and the Beast, and this isn't necessarily something that people dwell on, but one of the earliest known versions of Beauty and the Beast seems to be an oral tradition in which the Beast was actually a werewolf.
Oh.
Which I think makes some sense if you think about it. Yeah. He is a man who is transformed by a curse into an animal.
Right. Yep.
And it repels, you know, he it's the story in part is about his struggle with his human and animal instincts, much as it is in Beauty and the Beast. At least on one level. And you can incorporate those kinds of ideas very easily. Again, look back, Bluebeard, which I mentioned earlier, another classic fairy tale. Is considered another example of one of the earlier forerunners of that tale involves an aristocrat who I believe was French, not Gilles de Rais. This is before even that. May have been legendary, but there's belief that he may have been a werewolf, right? And that he ate all of his wives and left the bones in a chamber. And now he has a new wife, and he's like, oh, just don't go into the chamber, you know. Well, you know, we know how that turns out always, right? I want to emphasize again, too, the idea should also be there should be an element of transgression. Like, the villagers are not going to step foot in that place.
Right.
There is something out there, or there is some rule that's imposed. Perhaps, you know, there's a giant that strikes fear in them if they do certain things. Or they have to appease the giant, make offerings to it so that it doesn't come. And you can see how these elements that are at work in fairy tales are very much things that are you find in D&D and throughout fantasy. You were mentioning, this brings us full circle, I think, in that you were asking about appendix and authors. You find a lot of this throughout most fantasy. You find it in a lot of Paul Anderson is really good at riffing off of those kinds of motifs. You find elements of them throughout most of the stuff that I mentioned to you that came out of Unknown during our previous Appendix Ed discussion. Yeah. You find elements of these just strung together. Lord Dunsany's stories are heavily influenced, of course, by fairy tales and by, you know, the so-called Oriental or Orientalist tale and by those kinds of traditions. Right. Of the short piece, and you can't really go wrong, I think, with looking at some of these things and saying, gee, this worked. It still works in some form. I mean, the fairy tale form. I mean, you've gone through Victorian boulderization and watering down into the symbolists and decadence, like, and later 19th century, where you get cool stuff like Hans Christian Andersen, who is just a master of the downbeat ending. And yeah. Oscar Wilde's fairy tales, right? The Ugly Prince. And all the way through into today's period, some of the authors who are on Mulvey's list, Tanith Lee, she's departed, but she did a number of short stories that were revisions of, recastings, new fresh takes on fairy tales.
Right.
And likewise, one of her great contemporaries, Angela Carter, who did a film I would definitely recommend, The Company of Wolves, that was inspired by some of her short fiction, where it's like, what if Red Riding Hood actually doesn't have a problem with the wolf having eaten grandma? These cool kind of takes on the fairy tale.
That's right.
And quite often, Tanith Lee and Angela Carter, even though they're vastly different writers, one thing they share in common would be a very wicked sense of humor, which I very much appreciate, and which you find in a lot of old fairy tales, because again, these are things playing at boundaries and dealing with transgression and the world, this world and the next.
Right.
So within the context of the fairy tale itself, to draw the distinction, both how this was, how fairy led into the idea of fairies led into the fairy tale, the conte de fées, and also how they're somewhat different things. The fairy tale picks up some of those ideas, but you don't need a fairy in every fairy tale, right?
Right.
And certainly not every fairy tale, when you encounter something that's fey or otherworldly or a talking animal or whatnot, it's not going to be a friendly Disney character necessarily. And so, yeah, it's important to keep those things in mind and keep the player on their toes, I think.
Yeah. Wow, time is zipping by. I also wanted to plug Tolkien's essay on fairy stories, where he says, kind of broad brushing, that the essence of a tragedy is a catastrophe, but the essence of a fairy tale is the eucatastrophe, how would you describe that? It's a catastrophe that ends up turning good at the end. It's the happily ever after ness of the, but as you mentioned, some of the earlier forms of fairy tales, especially in Hans Christian Andersen, I'm thinking of Little Mermaid, does not end happily ever. In the original version, the Little Mermaid doesn't get, she ends up turning into sea foam and whatnot. So, that kind of thing can be exactly the kind of thing a DM can prep. He can prep the downbeat Hans Christian Andersen ending if the players go wrong, and he can prep the "and they lived happily ever after" ending if they do it right. But I wanted to plug that essay because it's a really good essay on fairy stories.
And I would also just for reading, just for the sake of reading, Jack Zipes, who is one of the current leading scholars in the field of the fairy tale. There's a really good Norton anthology, or Norton Critical Edition, I should say, where he collects several hundred fairy tales, and it has essays examining them from different points of view. Now, that might sound academic, but trust me, it's actually quite fun, because you get different takes on what these fairy tales, their history, where they originated, what they mean. I recommend that, and I'd also recommend, I believe it's Pantheon Books, has a series of trade paperbacks where each volume collects, for example, Scandinavian folklore and fairy tales, and Cornish, and say Cornish folklore, and fairy tales from Hans Christian Andersen, and fairy tales from the Brothers Grimm. And they're great compilations, because of course the Brothers Grimm, as part of their interest in German culture, went around collecting all these fairy tales. So yeah, I would highly recommend those kinds of collections.
And if you're
and they have Japanese, Chinese, Native American. They have a wide variety of different folkloric sources, and they're all reasonably priced, I think.
And this seems to be a popular thing recently, because the Mary Mushman, who publish OSR kind of stuff, they published a folklore bestiary for both OSR systems and 5e. And it's got a lot of, and all of the monsters in there are drawn from real world folklore that didn't make the DMG or the monster manual. And so they're all this kind of weird, otherworldly kind of thing. So I think they're just the kind of monsters you might want to pull out every once in a while and toss in the Gnarly Forest or the Vespa, these kinds of things. You can get it at the Mary Mushman. This whole discussion reminded me of some of the monsters in that book, and some of the because it doesn't just give you the monsters, it gives you the setup and the folklore behind it, so you can now incorporate that into a game and actually begin to use some of these elements.
And if you don't mind, there's one other source that I would recommend people look at, and it's film version. Penguin has a good translation of something called The Tale of Tales, which is a collection of fairy tales and folk tales by Gian Battista Basile, who was a Neapolitan writer of the 1600s. And that his sources his texts, rather, were later adapted by the Brothers Grimm. And in fact, the Brothers Grimm offered a great text praising them as an example of him collecting some of the Neapolitan lore. And Charles Perrault, of course, I mean, from some of the stories that were in there include like Puss in Boots and Rapunzel and Hansel and Gretel. Those are all in The Tale of Tales. But the reason I'm recommending it is there is a story in that text, and this gives you a good example of the variety that you get with fairy tales. There's a tale called The Flayed Lady, which I was thinking in terms of the madness of, say, the Aerdy court, you know, Ivid and his kin. It's the kind of tale that you could easily tell about one of those decadent Aerdy nobles. And it involves a man who is visited by a woman when he's in his bed, and he loves her until he sees her face and realizes that she's an old woman. And he proceeds to have her flayed. Yes. And a witch comes upon her and restores her, and her beauty is restored. And basically her sister, who is also an old woman, now the guy wants her, right? Now that she looks pretty. So the guy basically approaches, or the sister approaches and is like, why does he want you now? Why is it, would he show no interest in me? And she's like, well, you know, I was flayed and then I was healed. So of course, basically the woman then, the other sister proceeds to go out and basically get herself flayed, but there's no witch to help her. Very dark kind of story. And there was a film version of this movie a few years back by, I believe his name is Garone, an Italian director, with John C. Reilly and Salma Hayek and others in the cast. And it adapts three of the stories. Basically, so you have a maiden, mother, crone kind of structure to it. And but I would highly recommend both the film and the original text as you can find it in the Penguin translation.
That's awesome.
And like I said, I think you can definitely find some inspiration for some Aerdy wickedness in that tale and some of the others.
So, man, this was a lot, and it's like, what's interesting to me about all this is all of this stuff, you know, the things in Appendix N and all the things you've talked about, all I could see some examples of many of these, whether it be the story structure or the maybe the lack of morality or the good turns out to not be good, or the bad is allowed to just be bad. All of those elements I can see in Gary's adventure writing and in some of the politics and larger narratives that are in the canon of Greyhawk. And so we've covered, right, the fairy tales tend to take place on the edge, yeah, of things, right? And so we have the Fae with the Fae Crossing. That's what I was trying to think of earlier. But then you can take these characters and ideas and use those very same kind of structures or patterns or tropes to set up a good narrative as a DM. Or even you could maybe copy that character from a fairy type tradition as your player character. You know, from the player's perspective, you can apply the structure of these things to your games, to the narratives in your games. And so Mateus kind of points out here in these little notes I'm getting, read fairy tales to your kids or your grandkids, and you're actually DM prepping at the same time, and your
absolutely
spouse will never know.
And don't forget that, like, it would be kind of, it's always kind of neat if one of your players, who, like I said, is a ranger or a druid or a bard, happens to know there's tales of this monster, and they happen to remember that there's an old story that they heard or an old ballad that they were trained in that seems to be about something quite similar to this. I've done that with my own players. And by the way, it doesn't only have to be those classes. What if there's a monster that's killing people or is on the loose, and some of the signs that it's left behind remind a character of a frightening story they were told when they were little?
Yeah. Yep, that's right.
And yeah. So, yeah, lots of ways we can incorporate that kind of
material. Yeah. And you can see that some of this stuff informed what Gary and the other writers in the early TSR days pulled together for lore and stories and adventures. So pretty interesting. From my perspective, I always felt like very little connection or very little use of the Fae in particular with Greyhawk, but it's most certainly there, and it informs and it inspires a lot of the races, dwarves and elves and magic and things. So it's very much there. It's maybe just more subtle.
And you have a lot of it in the Monster Manual and Monster Manual 2.
Yeah, for sure. You sure do. So, and I feel like this is a topic that could probably go on for days. There's just so much there. So many examples of stories, so many different ways to incorporate the various elements we've talked about. So
I hope that these, just as with the previous episode, I'm hoping that this kind of gives people a groundwork and a foundation if they're unfamiliar with the material, or a reintroduction if they are familiar with the material.
Yeah, yeah.
To thinking about these things. And then we can go on to specific authors once these are done.
Yeah, and so, if you're a DM or a player out there and you want to know more about this, or you have questions or ideas you want to share, drop them in the Grey Guildhall Discord. Talk about them here and there, wherever you find Oblivion Seeker or myself or Mateus. Cause it's a pretty interesting topic, and it has a lot of, tendrils and threads and things that could be pulled. So, Les, we appreciate you coming on.
A pleasure, sir.
To take another view of some stuff on Appendix N, another really interesting, chock full of stuff, conversation, if you will. So thank you. And Mateus, any other thoughts as we wrap things up? Any other pearls of fairy wisdom, if you will?
Pearls of fairy wisdom. No, everybody stay safe. Stay kind, and we'll see everybody on the next episode.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Greycast Podcast, where we explore the world of Greyhawk one podcast at a time. Mateus and I are excited to share our passion for the world of Greyhawk with each of you. We'll drop episodes every other Monday featuring all things Greyhawk. Please refer us to all your cool, nerdy Greyhawkian friends and allies, even your most hated enemies at the gate. You can find our podcast on Spotify, and be sure to give us a follow on Twitter at Greycast576 to keep up with Greycast. Until next time, remember, it's a dangerous business going out your door. You step onto the road, and if you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you might be swept off to.